in the kinds of moral goals that the people who are in national liberation movements also believe in, or do we not? Do we believe in land reform? Some of them happen in Vietnam and in Cuba and in Bolivia and elsewhere to believe in land reform. Do we believe in land reform? Is this a good thing for these countries? You know, we've got to get down to this level and not to the level that I think Kennedy, I think you're quite correct here, was trying to move on to when he says what we have to do is find some a series of what amounts to American technical solutions, another gadget, another sort of military means to counteract a social movement. And the social movement is a movement that has a philosophical base, and we're not going to meet national liberation war on any military counterinsurgency basis. We've got to meet it on its own basis, and then I think we have to look back into our own society for the answers rather than...
room that we have to go into the next segment of the program, which is the portion devoted to the world press discussion of this problem, the foreign press, and that then immediately thereafter, it will be time for our third panel on the so-called wars of national liberation. So at this time, we will have the world press roundup of foreign opinion.
Can we not have just a brief...
Whenever Vietnam is discussed, the United Nations keeps popping up, and many are saying today that it's just hopeless as far as getting any help from the UN is concerned. How is your press treating the UN vis-a-vis Vietnam? Leslie.
The British press, Roger, takes the view that it's hopeless for the United Nations to try to do anything for the simple reason that communism...
assumptions about the nature of this war are frequently left unstated. We're going to begin by asking for some definitions, asking our panelists to make a brief statement as I introduce each one of them. And gentlemen, Conrad, we hope that each of you will describe the war as you see it. In other words, do you see it as basically a civil war or an international aggression by North Vietnam or an aggression by the United States or indirect aggression by Communist China or some combination of one of these? And we'll now ask each of our panelists, I hope briefly, to try to give us his definition so we can at least set the stage to that extent, and if not, at least to indicate the breadth and diversity of opinion. Our first guest will be Mr. James Farmer, who is a consultant and former staff member on the RAND Corporation staff. He worked on military research in Vietnam under United States Air Force contracts and presently is Director of Institutional Studies at the Computer Center, San Fernando Valley State College. Mr. Farmer?
Conflict in Vietnam can be seen as an outgrowth of nationalism and the desire for economic betterment on the part of the Vietnamese people. It can also, and perhaps more importantly, be considered as a symbolic confrontation between insurgency as a strategy, that is, a campaign of social, economic and military attrition, and a U.S. effort to demonstrate that this strategy is in fact unrewarding. The U.S. has been unsuccessful in the sense that the United States has not accomplished the goals of a viable, independent nation, but it has been successful in the sense that it's prevented the supported National Liberation Front from achieving national power. The United States has responded by a policy of ratcheting escalation and attempts, sometimes feeble, at integrated economic and military action. The National Liberation Front, for For them, the conflict has become an unending and in large part unrewarding effort. For the North Vietnamese, it's become a national campaign of brave endurance. Now, while we consider most alternatives are discussed in either the two extremes, abrupt, precipitous withdrawal, or massive escalation, it seems to me that there's a wide range of alternatives which have yet to be explored, and I hope this can be done in part tonight.
Our next panelist is Mr. Charles Gould, who is the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner, a captain in the United States Naval Reserve, and very recently visited South Vietnam on extended service. Mr. Gould?
My friend, you're looking at a militant, dove-like hawk. I hate war and love peace. But I love peace enough to fight for it, and we are fighting against international aggression in Vietnam. We are fighting for true world peace. I'd like to put that into a historical frame of reference. Ask any person of intelligence who lived through the guilt-ridden days of Buchenwald whether the United States, Great Britain, and France were not derelict in their responsibilities to world order when they failed to stop Hitler at the start of his fanatical religious wars, and you will receive a resounding yes. We paid a terrible price for failing to stop the aggressors in the 1930s. 50 million casualties in World War II is a tragic monument to our failure. The forces of aggression are again on the march in the world. Since the end of World War II, we have seen Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Albania, China, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, North Korea, North Vietnam, Cuba, and Tibet disappear from the family of free nations. We must recognize that Vietnam is not a war. It is only a battle in a continuing war. It is a war that was given impetus when we restrained General Patton in Europe and permitted the Russians to first enter Berlin. It was given more impetus when we forced Chiang Kai-shek into a coalition government with Mao Zedong. And when we failed to enter Manchuria during the Korean conflict, and when we turned a deaf ear to the pleas of the Hungarian patriots in 1956, and when we turned away from the Cuban freedom fighters and deserted them at the Bay of Pigs. The never-ending communist drive for world domination will gain new impetus if we falter in the present fight. For if we fail to stop red aggression in that tortured land across the sea, I am sure that Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Australia, Japan, and Korea will be battlegrounds of the future. And if we fail to curb the enemy, we will find our children facing him on our own shores. I hate war, but I hate slavery more, and that's what I'm advocating in our campaign in Vietnam.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. Our next guest is Dr. William Nieswanger. Between the years 1962 and 64, he served in Vietnam as the senior U.S. Aid representative for Da Nang and the surrounding province of Quang Nam. He's assistant professor of political science at Sonoma State College and the author of Rural Pacification in Vietnam and War Without Guns. Mr. Nieswanger.
Well, after I got back from Vietnam this last time, spending the summer there, I became more convinced than ever that it was terribly important for us to be there. Us as Americans participating with another nation and influencing that nation to establish itself with its people. However, I think we can define the war in this way. It's a competition of two organizations, actually two governments that are in existence and functioning in South Vietnam. One government has, for the most part, rural areas. Another government has, for the most part, urbanized areas. And the competition is on for large portions of the rural areas. This competition is to establish control and legitimacy by destroying and supplanting the other side. One of the difficulties in trying to face up to negotiation on this basis is that there is very little that you can cut in two here. We've already cut the nation in two once. I should say also that in defining the war, I think it's simplest and most mechanical and easy in terms of function to think of this war as a renewal of that war that preceded up to the Geneva Agreement. It is a renewal in which it manifests itself in the South only since the North has been ceded by everyone that I know anything about except the South, ceded to a power that has established itself. The National Liberation Front is, I think, for all practical purposes, an extension of the government of North Vietnam, although certainly the way it manifests itself in the South, the issues that it discusses, and its leadership is, for the most part, indigenous and to the South. But the key decisions still are made as one movement, the revival of the Viet Minh. It was one movement beforehand, before 1954. It still is essentially one movement with a single purpose, to dominate all of Vietnam with a new communist socialist state.
Thank you, Dr. Neiswanger. Our next guest is Felix Green, an author and journalist, one of the few American-based correspondents who has visited North Vietnam and mainland China in recent years. He's the author of a series of articles in the San Francisco Chronicle last June and of several books on China, the latest of which was Vietnam, Vietnam. Mr. Green?
Well, I agree with the last speaker that this is, in fact, a continuation of the war fought by the Viet Minh. But the Viet Minh were fighting the French, who were trying to reimpose a colonial regime. So I see this not, in fact, as aggression from the North. In fact, the war had begun long before anybody even talked about aid from the North to the South. But it started before then. And I do not define this war in terms of a civil war either. When the Vietnamese were trying to get rid of the French had a group of Vietnamese supporting them, but no one called this a civil war then. When the Germans, it's always easy to get local people to support you, a certain number. Even Hitler got some people in France to support him. And no one has ever called the resistance against Germany in France a civil war. This is no civil war. It is a war of aggression by the United States, and it's as simple as that.
Our next guest is Dr. Richard Brody, who is professor of political science at Stanford University, a fellow of the Center for Advanced Study with the Behavioral Sciences, and a man who has worked and done extensive work in connection with polls regarding United States public opinion on the war. Dr. Brody?
Well, as I see it, the war began as a civil war when the remnant of Vietnam responded to the malpractices of the Diem regime, with minor U.S. intervention and North Vietnamese intervention between 1954 and 1964. Certainly since 1964, we vastly increased our commitment and North Vietnam responded in order to save the Viet Cong from going down the drain. And since that time, really since 1965, it's been a war of mutual and asymmetrical escalation with the U.S. using modern weapons and the North Vietnamese essentially using men to try and save the Viet Cong and South Vietnam.
Thank you, Dr. Our next guest is Mrs. Marion Conrad, who is the head of her own public relations firm in San Francisco. Has been active in civil rights and civic affairs groups in San Francisco, the mother of three children under 12. Mrs. Conrad?
Thank you, Cap. I find myself in total agreement with Felix Green as a starting point, but then, since I am the mother of three and the only woman on the panel, perhaps you can indulge me in saying the words that women are known to say, such as, I feel this is an immoral war, that it's a senseless war, it's a war that is not should not be pursued legally, illegally, or any other way. I think that we've found ourselves going laboriously up a down staircase of escalation until at this point we're 7 miles, I think, from the top, which would be the bombing of China, and total war and total oblivion. I think we now need the courage to start going back down the up staircase and de-escalating rapidly or slowly or headlong, but whichever way, we should realize that we're going in the direction of morality and of peacefulness and of really truly a pragmatic direction.
Our next guest is Mr. James W. Halley, a distinguished San Francisco attorney and the chairman of the Republican State Central Committee of California and a member of the Republican National Committee. Mr. Halley?
Today, the United States and other allied powers are providing assistance to the Republic of South Vietnam in defending itself against armed attack from the Communist North. The government of South Vietnam has requested this aid. The attack has taken many forms: infiltration of armed personnel, the sending of regular units of the North Vietnamese Army into the South, supply of arms and equipment. South Vietnam and the United States are engaging in collective self-defense. One time, French colonialism would be replaced by the new colonialism of the communist cause, but for our action. Our national commitments embrace three American administrations and arise from a national determination to preserve Southeast Asia from communist domination and to meet the challenge of wars of liberation that in fact are modern wars for colonial empire. We are committed and should honor our pledges to the Republic of Vietnam, our responsibilities as a leader of the free world, and our obligation to generations of future Americans.
Thank you, Mr. Halley. Our next speaker I'll introduce in just a moment. Before I do that, let me present on my immediate right Dr. Urban Whitaker, who is the Professor of International Relations at San Francisco State College, member of the National Board of the United Nations Association, and we're going to utilize his services as an expert on the United Nations at an appropriate point in the panel. Our next guest is Mr. Robert Coate, a distinguished San Francisco businessman who is the Northern California chairman of the Democratic State Party in California, and who also just recently returned from a visit to South Vietnam. Mr. Coate.
Thank you, Cap. The United States responded to a request from the Republic of South Vietnam to help it defend itself against the attack from the National Liberation Front and from North Vietnam. In my opinion, we have completed the big share of our job. Our job was to help the South Vietnamese, the Republic of Vietnam, preserve itself long enough that it could commence developing some kind of a strong government, some kind of an economy, so that it could live in independence in Southeast Asia. I believe that the formation of the new government, which is going on there now, has in fact attracted competent people, that it is broadly based. From my observations there recently, I have great confidence in the ability of this government to take over on November the 1st and to commence the business of building the kind of solid base. The war in Vietnam is a political war as well as a military war, and there is no simple military solution to this. The Republic of Vietnam has to have a government sound enough that institutes enough reforms that people in Vietnam will not want to go to some other form because they're not getting satisfactory government at home. Without this, the rest of it is in vain. Now, I have, in the United States, observed principally there are two loud and growing voices. One says, win the war quickly and get out, and the other says, just get out. It's my belief that we have been there for a purpose, that we are past the midpoint of fulfilling that purpose, that it to assume that an escalation or any kind of military action will, quote, win the war is so oversimplified as to be unfair to America to say, that anyone who assumes that we should turn around and drop everything and get out after the investment of lives we've made so far is equally simple-minded, and I hope that the panel will be able to reach some conclusions that are in the real world and with a third dimension other than those two.
Mr. Coate, our final guest is Mr. Paul Jacobs, author and freelance social critic, staff member of the Center for Democratic Institutions at Santa Barbara, author of The State of the Unions, Prelude to Riot, Growing Up Absurd, The New Radicals, and many other books. Mr. Jacobs?
I thank you, Cap, for attributing Paul Goodman's book to me. That's very nice. I think the war in Vietnam is one in which a large counter-revolutionary society, the United States, is attempting to destroy the national identity of a smaller society. I think that this war in Vietnam is a product of the Cold War, although it is no longer directly connected to it in reality, and that it is a representation of a general policy of the United States which finds its expression not only in Vietnam, but in Latin America, in Africa, and in every other part of the world. I think, too, that whatever disagreements I have with the Viet Cong's tactics and its philosophy, I believe that it represents the aspirations of the Vietnamese people for a national freedom and against domination by colonial powers. And that aspiration and that feeling of the Vietnamese is a feeling which has been in existence for more than 2,000 years. Finally, I think it is a war in which the United States must accept full responsibility for the destruction of any other force in either North or South Vietnam, which could act as a counterbalance to the Viet Cong. And indeed, in my opinion, the Republic of South Vietnam is no more than an instrumentality of the United States government.
Thank you, Jacobs. As you'll see, this indicates, if nothing else, the breadth of diversity of viewpoint. And we're very grateful to all of our panelists for expressing their widely divergent viewpoints so concisely. The present United States policy defines the war as international aggression by North Vietnam against South Vietnam, assisted by the South Vietnamese members of the National Liberation Front, or the Viet Cong. There are two sides to the official United States strategy for peace in Vietnam, peace through war and peace through negotiation. The first of these was articulated most recently, I suppose, by Ambassador to the United Nations, Arthur Goldberg. He said that the conflict should be ended by a political solution at the earliest time, and that the United States does not seek, never has sought, a military victory. He outlined the principles of such a settlement in terms of the Geneva Agreement. He said we would expect negotiations to achieve a complete ceasefire, the withdrawal of all foreign troops, and the demobilization of all others not under the control of the government of South Vietnam, respect for international frontiers as established, peaceful settlement of the reunification question without foreign interference, and international guarantees of whatever settlement was achieved. Ambassador Goldberg also indicated that the settlement should guarantee that no South Vietnamese, either Viet Cong or others, should be barred from full participation in the political life once the settlement was put together. The ambassador's statement suggested that bombing of the North would be halted if Hanoi guaranteed that negotiations would follow, which seemed to some observers at least to be a shift from an earlier demand for a corresponding de-escalation by North Vietnam or some other concession in the event we should agree to halt the bombing again. While seeking negotiations, the United States has carried on the other side of its policy, that is, an attempt to use massive military forces to gain the goal of a stable and independent self-governing South Vietnam. So long as the communists have refused to discuss settlement with us, we are committed to continuing the war, which, of course, as any war does, involves killing as many of the enemy as possible, destroying the environment in which they are operating, and cutting their flow of supplies from the North or from wherever they are getting supplies. United States spokesmen say that we will continue fighting until the enemy gives up his aggression, and the more optimistic forecasters say that this might happen by 1969 or 1970. Well, as we indicated at the beginning, we have two panels, a panel to discuss primarily the effect of all of this on the country of Vietnam itself, and a panel to discuss political and other effects of the United States. So let's start with our Vietnam panel with the general question of why has this strategy of negotiation thus far at least failed to bring the other side to the conference table? Why, if everybody wants peace, can't we get negotiations?
I'd like to volunteer a remark, if I may, and I'd like to address it to Mr. Felix Green, who has visited Hanoi and who has talked with Ho Chi Minh. He wants to see the war end, and so do I. Less than 4 hours ago, I talked with Washington. And if Mr. Green will deliver Ho Chi Minh to Paris or Rome or London or Moscow or Geneva or New York or Washington or San Francisco or Glassboro for the purpose of serious peace negotiations, I am prepared to guarantee the personal participation of the President of the United States. You name the time, you name the place, you name the hour, President Johnson will be there. You deliver Ho Chi Minh, put up or shut up.
Well, let's reverse that. Mr. Ho Chi Minh has invited Mr. Johnson to come and visit him in Hanoi to discuss peace, but I didn't hear any response from President Johnson to that invitation.
I don't think that there was any official invitation
now,
from Ho Chi Minh to President Johnson.
I would also like to ask you something else. I'd like to ask you to engage in a little role reversal. Supposing this country was being bombed, supposing by the Japanese in the last war, and at the same time that the bombing was being continued, requests for discussion were being transmitted. It reminds me a little of the situation after the fall of France, when Hitler and the German High Command wanted to come into communication and have discussions with London on the grounds that the war could then end. And they used much the same language. Everybody wants peace. Why can't we have peace? And he even went so far as to order, a bombing pause on London, awaiting the answer to these things. Well, the British said, to hell with you. There is no real intention behind those requests, and the mood in Hanoi today is in exactly the same way, and it would be the same here, to hell with you. Until we believe that you really mean this, until you begin to demonstrate not by escalation of your forces, not by the expansion of your big installations in the south, but by the beginning of some tangible indication that you mean to fully withdraw from both north and south, they will continue to say, to hell with you, we don't believe you.
I'd like to challenge both of these gentlemen, if I may. I think they're ignoring the question that was put. Why has this strategy of negotiation not worked? All they've said is that the other side won't play fair and won't cooperate. I would like to say that there's nothing to negotiate, which I essentially said in my first statement. Both sides want the same thing, and you can't cut it in half. I will add this: on the American side, we cannot afford to withdraw at this time. There is not the beginning, or if there is, it is only a beginning, of a viable society in the South. If we begin to negotiate after we have withdrawn our forces, it won't be long before the negotiations break down, because the country in the South has already been taken over by the National Liberation Front. We must have our forces there if we intend to accomplish the objectives that we've set out for. So I think it's really, we're just batting the breeze here if we talk about negotiation. It's only a neat little cover to make us look like doves, I'm afraid that President Johnson's in this shape. He really has nothing to negotiate except the return of a number of American flyers. But he cannot give up in the South without he cannot give up anything without giving up everything. So negotiation is a point that's nice for academicians, but I think a waste of time in solving the problem of Vietnam today.
Didn't we have negotiations in Korea that ended in a stalemate, not a very satisfactory solution, but you did end with a divided country and a viable government in South Vietnam and a very prosperous.
Well, we already have the divided nation in South Vietnam and North Vietnam. Now, the question mark is, what are we going to do about the South? Now, if we were fighting in South Korea today, after having given the North away long ago, and trying to determine something about South Korea, what we actually did was set up the conditions for negotiations of a truce by actually pushing the North Koreans out of South Korea. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that is so.
I question whether there will ever be a viable government as long as that government is supported by a foreign power, and I don't care what foreign power it is.
You would say that also about North Vietnam, which is supported largely by the communists of Peking and of Moscow?
Well, I think the aid that they are getting from China and from the Soviet Union is military aid on a very different scale, of different order to the aid that this country, or the commitment, the involvement that this country has in the government of South Vietnam.
How long did North Vietnam survive without that aid?
How long did the Viet Cong survive before they got any aid from anywhere? They were fighting as an indigenous revolutionary power against Diem, a man whom our government, the government here, had chosen and elected to send back. He was living in this country.
Mr. Farmer?
Right, I'd like to give a different answer to your question. I think what we actually have is a situation where both parties feel that they're winning. Because of the fact that the objectives of the United States and the objectives of the North Vietnamese are quite different, we have a situation where Ho Chi Minh feels he's winning, because after all, he has demonstrated that that the U.S. appears to be powerless in response to his particular strategy and tactics. And similarly, the U.S. can feel that they're winning because, well, you can take statistics such as government control, or you can even just take the fact that the Viet Cong have not progressed. They have not followed the timetable set up by General Giap. So in this sense, both of them are winning, and since both are winning, it's hardly feasible for them to discuss ending, because neither one of them is being forced into a situation where he feels he should surrender.
Well, in a negotiation, you always assume that each side wants something. Is there anything that North Vietnam wants at this time?
Yes, certainly.
What do they want?
The total withdrawal of all American forces from both North and South Vietnam.
And what are they willing to give in return?
They're not ready to give anything, and they ask, why should they?
Well, is that a...
Why should they give anything for the withdrawal of a foreign power from their soil? Well, and there's another, if I may say, raise another point. There's a slight confusion that enters into this discussion, because we have tended to think of North and South Vietnam in terms of two sovereign, independent countries. And this has been, I think, gradually inculcated into our thinking. Now, I found very interestingly in North Vietnam that they do not think of themselves as North Vietnamese. They think of themselves as Vietnamese. Khi, and just to show how interrelated and intermixed they are, Khi comes from the north. Pham Van Dong, the prime minister of North Vietnam, comes from the south. The two people representing North Vietnam in London are both from Hanoi. The two people that I spoke to and had most dealings with in the Foreign Office in Hanoi were both originally from Saigon. So this idea that we're dealing with a people who have got an identity as North Vietnamese and an identity as South Vietnamese, and that there is an invasion and an aggression from one to the other, I think is part of the confusion in our thinking. It is not so.
I'd like to add to that, if I may. The South Vietnamese think precisely the same way about the North that the North Vietnamese think about the South. They think of one country that eventually they're going to have united. The only difference, and it happens to be a quantum difference, is that each wants the kind of society that they propose that they are building in one end of the country as compared to the other. Now, I might also add, however, and I think we're all aware of this, we just haven't mentioned it, that there are strong regional differentiations, however, and the Southerners are really part Central Vietnamese along the coast in the upper ranges of South Vietnam, and real South Vietnamese. They have different dialects. They have very different feelings and responses toward many political and social issues. And then, of course, we have the North Vietnamese overlay of a million refugees that came down from the North who are now in the South. So there really is a substantial differentiation among these groups that manifests itself in political questions.
Is the current cost of what's happening from the point of view of North Vietnam or South Vietnam a factor that is likely to lead to negotiations? We heard a moment ago the opinion that North Vietnam is not willing to give up anything. Is there anything that would bring the negotiations or bring a conference about within the foreseeable future? Is there anything that is apt to bring either side to the conference table? Farmer?
I don't, excuse me.
Well, if you're talking about explicit negotiations, I don't think so. However, I think that we may be at the point now where we can deal or consider implicit negotiations. That is, we can have a response by one party to something the other party does without actually being at a conference table. It seems, in discussing negotiations, it's rather insurmountable at this time to get to negotiations, that is, by force. I'm not discussing the international political situation.
Let me ask Mr. Gould, what is the What's the best outcome that could be realistically expected from a United States military victory? What would happen in the event we were able to achieve a military victory?
I think that we would have a situation somewhat comparable to the situation that presently exists in Korea, where it would be quite necessary for the United States to maintain a constabulary in South Vietnam to guarantee its survival during a building period. But I think that at this present hour, contrary to the views expressed by some of the other gentlemen here, I think that it is possible to have a negotiated settlement. I don't think that a negotiated settlement will solve any of the problems that face the world today. I think that it might be politically right for this government to push through for a negotiated peace that would hopefully not sell out South Vietnam, but would result in a cessation of hostilities and perhaps bring the United States in with an international force to guard the demilitarized zone or the 17th parallel. I think that this is possible because of the forces at work in our society today that affect every pocketbook in this room and every pocketbook in among the people in our viewing audience. I think that the rising costs are definitely a pressure for some kind of a conclusion. I think that the fact that we are spending 20 times as much in Vietnam as is Russia and China makes it economically feasible for both China and Russia to maintain support of the Viet Cong, and we must recognize that we are playing into their hands by this strategy.
Mr. Green.
I think, Mr. Gould, if you could spend just a few days or a week or two in North Vietnam, you would.
If you'll arrange it, I'll go, and you might be able to do it.
I can't do it. It's your State Department that would have to arrange that. And I think you would find there.
I think you have better communications with Hanoi than the State Department.
Mr. Green.
If I may be allowed to continue, Mr. Gould, what I was going to suggest was that your thinking in terms of negotiated settlement, it is quite possible that the American public may be ready for a negotiated settlement. The public of North Vietnam is certainly not. You are there in the same sort of mood. I go back again to the mood in Britain during the last war, where no negotiated settlement is on the cards at all. It's not on the agenda. Every last person in North Vietnam is ready to die rather than give in. And when a people are ready to die, they can no longer be intimidated, regardless of what you do to them.
Mr. Green, the North
Vietnamese can be killed, and they possibly will be killed, but they will not be conquered or will not be pushed into a submission that to them would be nothing but a military defeat.
Mr. Green, the Japanese had much the same spirit, the Germans had much the same spirit, and still peace negotiations did come about with the collapse of the military establishment in those two countries. And I believe that whenever we enter into a war, I think we should use all possible processes to avoid a military confrontation. But the hour and day that we enter into armed conflict on the battlefield, I believe we should use all of the power at our command to bring about a quick.
One of the possible results of that, or one of the possible costs, since we are talking primarily costs tonight in all senses of the term, would be a risk of Chinese intervention. And this has been much discussed when military escalation is raised. What would the risk of Chinese intervention be? What is there any way in which we can measure that possibility? Supposing we did pursue a policy that would lead to, at least would be based upon the desire to seek a military victory, would there be any real possibility of Chinese intervention? Gentlemen? Mr. Green?
Well, I think there certainly would be. The Chinese have announced and repeated that if, in fact, the North Vietnamese or the National Liberation Front feel themselves hard-pressed, that they will, in fact, respond to any request for aid. There's every evidence that one can find in China. I was there not long ago. And there's a great deal of evidence that in spite of their internal turmoil, that they're quite ready to move in if such aid was ever requested. I think the Chinese are fully determined to prevent a military victory on the part of the United States. And if this country is determined to get one, and if the Chinese are determined to prevent a military victory, then it seems to me that the danger of collision with China is very great indeed.
We have in our audience a gentleman who's going to participate on our third panel, which will look at the whole general problem of these wars. And this is Mr. Robinson, Mr. Thomas Robinson, who is a research analyst for the RAND Corporation, working on contracts for the United States Air Force. He is an expert on Chinese domestic and foreign policy, and he has advised us tonight that he will be speaking for himself and not as a representative of the RAND Corporation. Mr. Robinson?
Well,
this is on the specific question of the risk of Chinese intervention.
I think we almost realize that, of course, the Chinese have intervened in this conflict long ago. They have been sending quite a number of people to help repair railroads and to keep the lines of communication open. The real question I think that we are interested in regard to Chinese intervention is military intervention, either in the air over North Vietnam or more particularly in the south of Vietnam. And when we consider this question, I think there are quite a number of factors which enter into whether or not the Chinese leadership decides to intervene. And let me just list some of these and then draw a conclusion. One factor surely is the combination of interests and powers that the Chinese in particular have with regard to the north and the south portions of Vietnam. Now, with regard to the national interests of China with regard to Vietnam, I think we must distinguish between the revolutionary interest and what I would call the national interest proper of China. China has an interest in assuring the continued viability of North Vietnam as a national interest. It has a revolutionary interest in seeing that South Vietnam comes under the domination of the National Liberation Front and or North Vietnam. But these interests are different, and I believe that the national interest predominates. So I think we have to take these interests into consideration. A second factor is the scenario that one thinks of when talking about possible Chinese intervention. Often an event is a function of how we get to it, and I believe this may be the case in the Chinese situation too. A third factor is the controlling influence of the North Vietnamese regime themselves with regard to Chinese intervention. I don't believe that China is going to intervene in either the North or the South unless the North Vietnamese assent or ask for it. And they aren't going to do this unless they think they are losing the war in the South or are collapsing in the North, and I don't think they are at either of those two points. Another factor is the Sino-Soviet dispute. The problem here is that the Russians and the Chinese, neither of them are very anxious to intervene in the Vietnamese situation because of the great probability of coming into direct conflict with the United States, but also because they don't want to let the other one get the upper hand in Hanoi. And so if any intervention were to come about, it would have to be, by and large, equal weights from either power, and it's awfully hard for either of those two powers to come to an agreement with the North Vietnamese on what sort of weights to assign their own selves. So the conflict between the Russians and the Chinese, I think, is actually militating against Chinese intervention at the present time. Again, the internal situation in China is a very important factor in possible Chinese intervention here, and I think we all know about the problems of the Cultural Revolution, which tend, at the present at least, to keep Chinese arms at home.
We have another gentleman who is widely experienced in the whole problem of China, and this is Dr. Franz Sherman, who is professor of sociology at the University of California, former director of the Center for Chinese Studies. And Dr. Sherman, we're going to put this same question to you now, and then a little later get you on another panel on the whole subject. What do you think is the risk of Chinese intervention in the event of a major step up in American military effort?
Well, I think it's very great.
I think there's one thing that perhaps we'd better realize, that we're all Americans here, and no matter what our opinions are, we tend to see it from this side.
That's not quite accurate.
That's not quite accurate, but we're all in America. But the Chinese have for many years, and as late as last June, have said again very specifically that they are convinced the United States one day is going to attack China. Now, this may sound rather ridiculous, but there's been a lot of talk in Air Force circles about taking out the Chinese nuclear installations. And that is the form of attack initially that they're expecting. I say that the statement has been repeated many times, and the last time was by Foreign Minister Chen Yi, who, despite the Cultural Revolution, is still in power. Now, that's the question of when the Chinese are going to intervene is a $64 question that the American military ask constantly. Are they going to intervene? What are the chances? They ask the China experts, perhaps not so much now as they used to. Now, of course, the Chinese are not going to advertise when and if and under what circumstance they're going to intervene. I absolutely agree with Mr. Green. They will never permit North Vietnam to go down to defeat or, as Zhou Enlai was reputed to have said, to capitulate in a dishonorable settlement. Now, there was a report in the U.S. News and World Report early this year in January, relayed by a French journalist. And again, there's no way of knowing how true it is, but I would say from my own experience that it makes a certain amount of sense. In the spring of 1966, shortly before the Cultural Revolution, the Chinese informally relayed to the United States three conditions under which they would enter the war in Vietnam. Those conditions were, I don't know if there's any order of priority, that there'd be a land invasion of North Vietnam, two, that there'd be a direct attack on China itself, and let's say a direct attack being in its first stage is attacks on Chinese air bases along the border, hot pursuit. And our State Department has already said in April 1965 that hot pursuit, there will be no sanctuary, they will recognize hot pursuit, and let us also remember that North Vietnamese MiGs are now stationed in Chinese air bases. Let's not be too surprised if some attacks take place on the border air bases in the not-too-distant future. I'm not saying it will happen, but it's a clear possibility that it could. And the third condition, that the United States bomb the dikes which would cause flooding and innumerable loss of life. I don't know how many of you are aware of the fact that the bombing of the dikes has already begun. This is not only a genocidal war in South Vietnam, it's become a genocidal war in North Vietnam. And the bombing of the dikes is one of the final acts of genocide. Now, why would the Chinese intervene? They would intervene because of the flooding, the loss of life, that North Vietnam will no longer be a viable economic entity. If you kill too many people, they have to be supported.
Dr. Sherman.
Now, let me finish here. I'll be finished quickly. I'd just like to say here that these three conditions seem sensible to me. One, that the national integrity of North Vietnam is threatened by destruction of its economy through flooding. Two, that there be an actual invasion of North Vietnam. And three, an attack on China. I would just like to end by saying that signs already exist that we are inching toward all three of these possibilities. The bombing of the dikes, the bombing of targets close to the Chinese border, and talk again and again of China as our target of the new ABM system, and so on.
Let me ask you if you could respond very briefly to this question. Is communist China, in view of all of the internal turmoil that we read about, in condition to bring about any military intervention?
Yes.
May I ask a question of them?
Yes, we should get our other panel in here very shortly.
Well, they've raised some questions that ought to be answered before we go on.
Proceed.
And I'm not sure they intended to, and I'm not sure how far. But let me ask this question of both of them, in a sense, because I think this was the innuendo, that China would not let North Vietnam go down into defeat or dishonor. Is it possible that if they were losing in the South, and I think that mention was made by Mr. Robinson, that China might intervene because they were losing in the South? Is that the opinion of the two gentlemen?
That I do not know.
Mr. Robinson is not here.
It's very hard to say whether they would intervene when and if the South or the North Vietnamese conclude they're going to that they are losing in the South, I would rather doubt it at that point. The doctrine of national liberation war, as the Chinese, at least as I read the Chinese on this matter, would seem to me to give them an out if they wanted it at this point. As I say, I would distinguish between their interest in the North and their interest in the South. I think I would agree with France very directly that if there was a case of the North Vietnamese regime being threatened with extinction for whatever reason, surely China could not countenance that sort of thing, and they would intervene to help bring back North Vietnam to life. But in the South, I think it may be a different matter. Now, one can make arguments about this.
We're all in the area of speculation, I take it. Let's turn for a moment to our United States panel, which has been sitting here quietly absorbing all of this, but not with any chance to talk. The first question, I suppose, would be what, Dr. Brody, you've done quite a bit of polling and so on. What is your opinion of the general state of American opinion at this point on some of these various alternatives?
Well, it's very clear that the present state of American opinion is quite dissatisfied with the conduct of the war. The most recent polls indicate that by now majorities of the American public are disapproving of the way that President Johnson is handling the war. And moreover, the pace at which this dissatisfaction is emerging is ever more rapid. 21% have apparently changed from approving to disapproving in the last 15 months. Now, the question, next question is, which direction is this disapproval? Is it in favor of a more active war or a more passive war or stopping the war altogether? The recent polls seem to indicate that those people who have changed their position in the last 15 to 18 months are about 2-1 in favor of stepping up the war, in contradistinction to the those who disapproved of Johnson, say, a year ago, where the majority of those were opposed to stepping up the war. Now, even this has to be broken down a bit because they want to escalate in different ways. I think what you might call it a cheap escalation, although not, certainly not from the point of North Vietnam. Bombing is approved, but the increase in the number of troops is highly disapproved of. One might say that Johnson has now reached the limit of the number of troops that the American public is willing to countenance in Vietnam with about 500,000 troops. Already a year ago, there was majority disapproval of having 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and that disapproval continues and grows. So I think that it depends upon the nature of the escalation. It depends upon the nature of the situation as it emerges and the success of various policies. The public is more interested in the success than the particular policy itself, and they're very quick to change their mind on whether they approve or disapprove, depending upon whether their policy looks successful or not.
We have two gentlemen here whose ability to judge American opinion frequently is the price of their survival in their particular positions. Mr. Halley, the chairman of the Republican Party in California, and Mr. Coate, the Northern California chairman of the Democratic Party. What do you think about the state of American opinion on the subject?
Jim? I think that the, basically speaking, the American people at this point in time very, very much want some of the statements about the war and our involvement to make more sense than many of the statements seem to. People want negotiations because negotiations, as someone pointed out earlier, is a sounds like a handy way to to cover up all of the problems. In fact, negotiations seem to me to be very unlikely. I agree with the people who have expressed concern that whether these can occur or not. I don't believe anything meaningful in the way of a resolution of the war can occur until the Republic of Vietnam, until South Vietnam, can in fact enter into negotiations from some strength and can participate on its own and not in the shadow of the United States. And I believe that the establishment of the new government and the rapid efforts after November the 1st, when it takes over, to commence helping it gain the the necessary strength will be the surest way to get meaningful negotiations and to extricate the United States in the shortest period of time. In the meantime, if negotiations should suddenly become possible, splendid. Although I would not like to see any of our policies require us to sit and wait for that.
Mr. Helley?
I think there's very substantial dissatisfaction with the management of the war by the present administration. The attitude seems to be that the war has been here for a number of years, and so has this administration, and that we don't really have any answers to it. I feel that very strongly about this. Many people now say that the war is taking a turn and that it is doing much better. This may be so, but a puzzling thing is that this is one of the first wars people have ever tried to solve by plebiscite or poll or charter resolution in San Francisco, and still have very little of the fact upon which to base judgment. The truth of the matter is that we don't know. And I think one of the most important things would be that the President of the United States disclose all of the information that he can legitimately make available concerning the relative strength and status of the armies North and South, ours, the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese. So if we do have our people so deeply embroiled in this matter of individual judgment, they're at least doing it from some base of all reasonable information on the subject. And I personally believe that a large amount of the trouble in the nation today is attributable to this very thing, a non-disclosure of facts. The people are intelligent. They want to know. I think our first call is to the President of the United States to let us know the facts.
Well, I would like to just punctuate this in a way, Mr. Halley, in pointing out some popular signposts about how America possibly feels about this war. I think, for one thing, in my lifespan at any rate, that for the first time we have a war in which we don't have James Stewart or Cary Grant telling me on the screen that we're making the world safe for roller skating down Main Street. We're unable to have any movies out of Hollywood or television movies about the war in Vietnam. It's clearly an extremely unpopular one, and no one has been able to sell the idea that we're really making the world safe for hula hoops on Poplar, perhaps.
I would just comment. Part of the responsibility of leadership falls to the president. He has set his policies. They are policies that, for all we know as we sit here right now, may be meeting with some success. I think with respect to the internals, the American people, we can't expect him to be a Churchill, but I do think we can expect him to give more leadership and certainly more facts.
Mr. Jacobs?
I find a kind of insane quality about this discussion. And I'd like to, if I may, with all due deference to the members of the panel who I'm sure understand that I mean nothing personal. Indeed, in fact, I do mean a good deal personally. Let me see if I can lay out for a moment why I think this is an insane discussion. First of all, we're talking about the American public, the American people, as if one could categorize and put the American people into a box. There is no such thing as the American people. Inside the American people, there are clearly represented Mr. Gould, who says to Mr. Green, "You deliver Ho, and I'll deliver Washington," as if Mr. Ho were a product, a soap package that could be delivered. And it seems to me that's one view of the world. Then there's another view of the world, the one that I have, and the one that a group of other Americans have, which says openly and directly to the youth of America, resist the draft, avoid the draft, burn your draft card, refuse to serve in this war. Now, who's more typical of America? Clearly, Mr. Gould's America is a majority so far as my America is concerned. I represent, obviously, a minority group. Nevertheless, the significant thing about trying to, Mr. Gould, the last thing in the world you and I want to get to is an interrupting match. The last thing, believe me, sir. Now, the obvious sign evidence of what is happening in America is that for the first time in modern times, a large segment of the population is not just merely dissatisfied with, is the war being fought brilliantly enough? Is the war being fought toughly enough? Should we bomb more than we're bombing now? There is a significant section of the American population which says we ought not be in the war at all. And the debate is not about whether we ought to be bombing more or less. For the first time in the history of modern times, there is a significant population in this country which identifies with the enemy rather than with this country. So if we're going to discuss what the future looks like, what the polls look like, I think that in addition to stratifying, you should excuse the expression, the population in the fashion which Dick Brody has done, one has to add another element to it, which is, what about those groups in the society which are so dissatisfied with the nature of the war? And finally, I think that this conversation, that this discussion has an insane quality, because what we have been talking about is, how does America feel about the war? Well, how can America feel about the war when the entire operations of this society, the mass media from one end to the other, tell us that when the communists or the Viet Cong attack, that's a terrorist ambush. But when our soldiers attack, that is a brave act of heroism. Now, the fact of the matter is that it is extremely difficult in the country today, and has been extremely difficult in the country today, for the American public to know what is happening in Vietnam. And I don't lay this responsibility totally on the shoulders of the president. He is obviously partially responsible for the dissatisfaction, for the malaise Americans feel. But it is not totally his responsibility. It's the responsibility of the entire mass media in the society, which has accepted from the beginning, without seeking to challenge it, the basic assumptions under which this war is being fought. And yet, that is the area in which more and more Americans are beginning to seek for an answer different from the one which is being given to them.
Well, Mr. Jacobs, to keep the discussion within the general context that we've been going in, you have indicated, as I understood it, that you feel that the views you've just expressed are clearly minority views, although you said there was a substantial portion of opinion that held them. We have in this country and have had a system under which the majority view usually, no matter how it is induced, mass media or otherwise, determines eventually the policy. Is there any suggestion that you make that this should not be the case in this situation? The basic question was, what is the majority view at this time? And Mr. Brody expressed his opinions based on some polls, and Mr. Hawley and Mr. Coate expressed their opinions, and you've expressed yours as indicating yours is a minority opinion. What should happen now?
Well, for the purpose of the argument, purely for the purpose of the argument, since I'm uncertain about what the majority of the American people feel, but for the purpose of the argument, let me concede for the moment that the majority of the American public feel that the war in Vietnam ought to be pursued more vigorously with bigger bombs, better bombs, more napalm, so on. I would say that so far as I was concerned, that majority opinion would cut no weight with me at all, since I believe this war not only to be an incorrect war from the point of view of strategy and policy and so on, I believe very, very strongly it to be a totally immoral war. And in that situation, I would say, but based on the examples that we have had in modern times, in the Nuremberg cases, in the Eichmann trial, I would say that for that segment of the population of which I am a part, we would not be impressed by the fact that the majority felt this way. We will pursue, as we have to pursue, our efforts to resist this war in every way that we possibly can.
Well, then we would put...
Yes. Can I just answer one question, one response here? Mr. Jacobs looks old enough to have been around in 1941. I wonder if Mr. Jacobs remembers the divided nation we had prior to June 19, 1941, when Hitler and Stalin had a pact of non-aggression, and the White House was picketed by 100 people saying it was immoral for us to supply Great Britain with tanks and ships and guns and planes. That was immoral.
And then the pact was broken on, I think, June 19, 1941. And the boys went home with their picket signs. And the next day, they were back there saying, more aid, more assistance. Let's not forget that we've been divided before. And we've had the same dove-like sounds coming from you, Mr. Jacobs, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and we'll have them again.
Now, may I respond, Mr.?
You should.
I'll try to be political rather than personal.
Yeah, would you also try to be brief? Because
yes.
We have a great many
That's
other
a little
people.
More difficult. It's easier for me to be political than it is for me to be brief. The fact that in 1939, there were a group of Americans who were so deluded by the nature of the Soviet state as to accept the premises of the Stalin-Hitler pact is simply an example to me of how idealism can take people, and a commitment to idealism can take people down paths such as yours and such as they took. It is, however, so far as the politics of it was concerned, there was nothing in the country at that time of any size and magnitude in comparison with what we have today. And that's the big difference. There were some people who felt this way, but so far as the malaise of the society as a whole was concerned, I'm sorry, Mr. Gould, your example's a lousy one.
It didn't continue that long, but it was there, and it was on the college campuses from coast to coast, and it was in the Senate halls and in Congress, and in a lot of the papers that are now hawk-like in attitude, they were dove-like then.
Yes, but this is a very the only war, or these aren't the only two wars in which there have been differences of opinion. You can go down the list, 1812, the Civil War, the First World War, and so on and on and on. The problem that we have is one of working the thing out within the framework of our representative system of government, in which people are elected to public office to represent us at differing times with differing electorates. And I frankly hope and trust that overzealous pursuit of viewpoints other than those of the majority don't get in the way of this very fine machinery that's done so well for us so long.
Yes, but I think we have to recognize that this is a very different kind of war in the public view. World War II, there happened to be a poll, and if I may rely on poll data, Paul, just prior to the outbreak of the war, which showed that 50% of the American public favored a war with Japan and 50% of the American public opposed a war with Japan, and the war broke out. And this restructured American attitudes completely. And for 5 years, a very intense war, the American public continued to back the administration. Now, Korea changed this pattern markedly, and Vietnam has even exacerbated the change. This is a very different kind of war in the public mind. And I think we're deluding ourselves. We're not understanding the nature of the public response, be it a minority response. And I agree with you that there is a significant minority. There are 20% of the American people who presently, now that's 4 million people or something of the sort, or I'm probably short on my arithmetic, who are actively opposed to the war to the point where they say, get out tomorrow. Now, 20% of the American public is a sizable proportion of the American public. I mean, I was asked before about majorities. I can talk about minorities. More significantly, I think, there are certain minorities in the American public that are even more opposed to the war. And I think we see the manifestation of this, or we've seen it this past summer. There is no doubt in my mind at all that the American Negro is far more opposed to the war in Vietnam than is his white brother, if I may use that counterposition of terms. There's no doubt in my mind that the American woman is more opposed to the war in Vietnam, even though she's safer by virtue of her sex, than is the American male. So that there are substantial minorities in the American public who are actively opposed to the war and wish to see it ended by whatever means. And by whatever means does not include total war by any means here.
One of the problems with long programs is that we have to interrupt exciting discussions to identify the station, which we will do at this time, and our discussion will continue in a moment.
For those of you watching the live broadcast of this program, we'd like to announce that there will be a rebroadcast Sunday, October 1st at 3:30. This is KQED San Francisco.
Now we'll return to the discussion, and one of the points we're trying to conclude on or reach some conclusions is the general effect of all of the war on American public opinion, or the risks, we might say, of continuing the present strategy on domestic political life and institutions. We will continue with this for a moment or two, and then we ought to turn to some of the solutions or some of the proposals that have been made for ending the situation. Yes, who is sir? Next? Mr. Coate and then Mr. Green.
I would like to ask a question of Dick Brody regarding this thing. Dick, you were saying that 20% of the American people want out immediately, and then then you transposed the statement later and said 20% of the people want to see the war ended. Really, don't you mean that almost everybody wants to see the war ended, but the difference comes on how it's gone about?
I'm not used to speaking so fast and without lecture notes in front of me. This is one of the disadvantages of being an academic. You're quite right, of course. It's really a senseless question to ask how many people want to see the war ended. Everybody does. One reflection of this is that when we ask the American public how many would prefer to see a negotiated settlement to the present conduct of the war, 88% of the American public assented to that particular posture. So that I think you're right. A much larger proportion want to see the war ended than want to, you know, get out now.
And but would you agree that, pardon me, that the general term negotiated settlement would imply to most people a pretty quick, simple way to end it, and as such would be seem attractive without having many connotations beyond that?
No, because when you ask the public what would happen if, would you still approve of this if it meant general elections, for example, in which the Viet Cong became part of a coalition government, you still get majority support, over 50%.
I can see when you start breaking it down, but would it seem to me that the that the question of are you in favor of negotiations, I'd be pretty hard-pressed to find somebody who'd say no to that.
Well, once you only again, found 12% who were willing to say no.
Yeah, the arena, and I think that the essential point, as I understood it, that Paul was making, almost deafened me, by the way, is that if he would, that there are a lot of people in the United States who are unequivocally committed to a given position, and who do not wish to see us engage in any of the other parts that would lead on beyond that. And I gather from what I've heard other people say that there are some who feel that the United States can and should seek an instant, or as quickly as possible, a military victory. I'm satisfied from what I've learned from listening to people so far tonight that as far as U.S. opinion is concerned, that we're still on about the ground we were at the start, that in order to try to make sense, we can ask if you want peace and ask if you want negotiations, and everybody says yes, but we have to get to the point that I really don't believe that most people in the United States today would favor an instant solution that did not carry with it some degree of preserving the status of the Republic of Vietnam and withdrawing on the United States' part in some systematic way that made sense. And the majority would, in fact, reject the two extreme positions which we so frequently hear.
I'm going to call Mr. Green next, who put up his hand, then Mr. Farmer, and then we'll move into a discussion of the United Nations aspects of this.
Well, I want to say just briefly that I think it's absolutely absurd to drag in public attitudes towards Nazi Germany in relation to the present situation. There we were confronted with a highly armed, outspokenly aggressive nationalism in Germany, of a frightening kind. Our own security and our own interests were very directly threatened. Now, what actual threat are the Vietnamese posing to us today? One of the elements that I think have influenced public opinion in this country is the element of the bully. Here we are, the largest, most powerful, richest country in the world, deploying an enormous amount of military equipment and know-how and personnel and the latest gadgets, napalm, onto a tiny, backward Asian country of 30 million people, whose average income is 15 cents a day, who are backward even by Asian standards. And I think it's this element of the sheer mechanical brutality with which this war is being fought that is influencing not only a great many people in this war, in this country, but throughout the world. And that is a thing that hurts me more than anything, because I think it is putting this nation, I know Mr. Gould doesn't believe I love this nation, but I do. And the thing that disturbs me most about this war is the fact that this war is, in fact, bringing this nation to the lowest point of discredit around the world that I've ever known it to be. There are a great many people all around the world who are friends of the United States, who are horrified at the continuation of a war of this kind against a tiny little backward nation.
Mr. Farmer asked for recognition next.
I wanted to comment about the polarization that's taken place in the discussion. Bill Niswander and I were talking about this before the panel, that we're faced with these two alternatives. Neither one of them seem to be viable. It's one thing to discuss about the possibility or what the results of the domino theory would be. It's quite another thing as a president to take the responsibility to test that. And I don't think any president is going to do it by precipitous withdrawal. Similarly, it's one thing for Tom Robinson and others to discuss what China might do, but I'm sure that Tom wouldn't want to be in the situation of having to make the decision of how far can you go in bombing in China. Rather, I think we should perhaps pursue third alternatives. That is it possible for us to de-escalate and create another alternative? For instance, if in fact our bombing, the purpose of our bombing now, is to disrupt the flow of supplies to the south, couldn't we then confine it to an area just briefly north of the 17th parallel to demonstrate it's not the economic base of North Vietnam, but rather it's the supply shipment to the south? If, in fact, we're concerned with Vietnamese nationalism and the building of a nation, can't we reduce the economic pressure somewhat on South Vietnam by giving them somewhat more responsibility for their own development and giving them assistance of a slightly different type, rather than overwhelming them with American staff agencies?
Another suggestion that...
comment about the notion of polarization. I'll be very brief.
And very moderate.
The way in which it's been posed, the way in which Mr. Farmer posed it, it's as if, well, one has on the one hand and then on the other. Now, I don't accept that formulation at all. This is, in the civil rights movement, the formulation was made, on the one hand, there's the Ku Klux Klan, and on the other hand, there's the NAACP. Well, that's not a proper formulation at all. And what strikes me, Mr. Farmer, is incorrect in your description of the formulation as you put it, the polarization as you put it, is that I would put it in another way. I would say, on the one hand, there's right, and on the other hand, there's wrong. And now that kind of polarization is one which can't be avoided.
That's true.
Well, let me put this general area that we have not yet reached, and that is the possibility of United Nations action. There was a flurry of discussion a few weeks ago in Congress and elsewhere around the idea of sort of submitting the whole matter to the United Nations, or at least involving the United Nations. And a bipartisan group of senators urged President Johnson to renew the American proposal to the United Nations for a debate on the subject of the war. Secretary General Thant has been reported continuing to work behind the scenes, but he at least has been reported or quoted as saying that he seems to be convinced there's no direct action open to the United Nations. As I mentioned in the beginning, Professor Whitaker from San Francisco State College, who has specialized in the study of the United Nations, is here with us. And let me ask you initially, Professor Whitaker, why has United Nations activity thus far seemed to be not a possible means of solving this situation?
Well, it may be that the history of the Vietnam War will follow the history of this discussion. You try everything else, and finally, as a last resort, you mention the United Nations. We could hope it might work that way.
You're not the last resort, you're the middle resort. We've got another 2 hours.
I would like to be on record after hearing Paul Jacobs' accurate comment about the insanity of this discussion, that I was the only person at the table who had not spoken at that time. Now, let me give three very quick answers to this question. I give three answers because I think there are at least three ways in which you might expect the United Nations to act. You ask, why hasn't the United Nations acted? I think in one way, and perhaps much more important than we're willing to admit, the United Nations has acted and has been very effective, and that's the role of the Secretary General. U Thant, when there is an absence of such things in high places in the United States and in perhaps many other countries, has shown very intelligent, courageous, and timely leadership. He has put the questions. He has described the situation repeatedly. He has endangered his own job as if he were worried about whether he could hold it or not in order to bring to the attention of the people of the world, and particularly the people of the United States, alternatives which aren't mentioned by, or seriously mentioned by, our own leadership. We don't know how much effect this has had, but at a time when U Thant is saying these things, we begin to hear more and more Americans repeating them. And I disagree with my friend Paul Jacobs, who says that Mr. Gould, of all people, represents a majority of the American people. I happen to live in a county where the only congressional by-election of the year is going on, and we have 13 candidates, and we've been described, and not too inaccurately sometimes, as the Orange County of the North. And a majority of those candidates on the Vietnam War are doves, and they're doves because they think that's going to win them votes. And maybe U Thant has something to do with that. It's not a far-fetched notion. In any case, that's one thing the UN can do and does. That's leadership with the Secretary General. Now, the other two things, I can be more brief because we have been less willing to allow the UN to do anything. You mentioned the word direct action. The UN is empowered to take direct action of any kind, anywhere, provided that the United States, the Soviet Union, the English, and the French, and the Chinese agree. So the UN has not taken direct action because we have not been willing to give the UN the power to take direct action. The third area I would mention is the area usually associated with the General Assembly, which is not expected to take direct action but is expected to discuss major world crises and to make recommendations, to come up with resolutions, to provide the scene for direct as well as behind-the-scenes negotiation. It's not possible for the UN to do very much in this area simply because many of the major powers involved in the Vietnam crisis are not members of the United Nations. China, North Vietnam, and South Vietnam are all outside the United Nations, and you can't expect an organization which is supposed to make progress through negotiation and discussion to do so if the major parties aren't there. We're treating the United Nations as we did the League of Nations, and as we've seen even at this table, there are some people in the United States in fairly influential places who are still thinking back in the 1930s and fighting Hitler. We can't expect the United Nations to do any job if we continue to treat it like the League of Nations. We can't get much out of the United Nations if we're not willing to put something into it.
Is there any reason to suppose, Professor Whitaker, that if the United States did formally submit the whole matter to the United Nations, that the Soviet Union would agree to accept the reference? They have not thus far. They have indicated the feeling that it is a matter beyond the United Nations' purview. Is there any reason to suppose they would change this viewpoint?
Well, I don't suppose much. U Thant has also indicated that, and I've just indicated that. There's no reason to believe that the United Nations Security Council could take any effective action when you have to have the Americans, the Russians, the British, the French, and the Chinese agreeing. If they all agreed, we wouldn't have a problem.
Well, then there's another aspect that has recently been raised, or another international channel, and that's been the proposal that we reconvene the Geneva Conference. One of the co-chairmen of this conference, 1954 conference, was Russia. Is there any reason to expect that that proposal will work, that Russia will withdraw their apparent opposition to the reconvening of that conference?
I don't think we can find out until we make the proposal, and I think we should.
Has anyone made that proposal on the other side? Has there been any suggestion that this is a method of approaching an international discussion outside the United Nations?
I don't know.
Has anyone any views on that?
Well, I know that the question was was raised in Geneva at the United Nations meeting. The United States position was enunciated as being one that if Russia would simply indicate a willingness to have the matter introduced either in either form, either through the reintroducing the Geneva Convention or bringing the matter to the Security Council, that the United States was prepared to do so. And in a session at that point, the Russian representative flatly denied any interest in either proposal and considered them American smoke screens and would not carry the discussion to the point that it made any sense for the United States even to give serious thought to it.
One reason why the Soviet Union is on the surface reluctant to be involved in the reconvening of the Geneva Convention is that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Minh and the Viet Cong feel, with some justice, in view of past history,
that they'll get sold out by the Russians, as they feel they may also be sold out by the Chinese, because that's precisely what happened. And so there is in the feeling, so far as the North, and here again, you would be asking the Soviet Union to deliver something it can't deliver. And the Soviet Union is in the position now where, having it just recently also been asked to deliver something they couldn't deliver, in the case of the Middle East, are likely to shy away from this. The fact is that so far as the North Vietnamese are concerned, their view of what has to be done does not at this point include a discussion by the great powers about what's going to happen to their country. What they're interested in is the end of the war and the bringing of the foreign troops in their case, out of the country. And they don't feel that it's necessary to do this. And they do have this fear that if there is such a conference, they will again end up, as they did the last time, on the short end of the stick.
Yeah, their position is briefly this, that the Geneva Conference was held, but it was not implemented. The Geneva Conference is still, that the findings and the decisions of the Geneva Conference are still there. Implement them. So why have another meeting?
Of course, no one actually signed them, did they?
They were all agreed to. They're not concerned. You see, they're not concerned with signatures. They're concerned with intent. Mm-hmm. And what do the people intend? What does the United States intend? Does it, in fact, intend to withdraw from Vietnam? Ho Chi Minh said to me once in a private conversation, and he said it elsewhere, so I can repeat it here. What we're really looking for, he said, is some credible evidence that at the highest point of government in the United States, a decision has been taken to withdraw from North and South Vietnam. He said, if ever we felt that this decision had been taken, we would make it easy. We would know the political difficulties. We could phase it out over a certain length of time. But until that decision has been taken, or we believe it has been taken, we're not ready to discuss it. And I think he's right. I don't think that decision has been taken.
Cap.
Is there any quid pro quo that should be exacted in return for a decision of that kind, in your opinion?
Well, in the opinion of the North Vietnamese, they feel that they are the victims of a monstrous injustice.
Yes.
What have they ever done to the United States that now that the they should now give the United States some quid pro quo for withdrawing?
They could agree to stop bombing Washington.
Yeah. I mean, to them, this whole idea of having something in return from an aggressor is outside the way they're thinking altogether, and I think rightly.
Is there anyone here who feels that there is some hopeful outlook for international accord or international negotiation or international solutions which could bring about some sort of settlement? Or does everyone feel that this has to be something that is settled in a sense between the parties?
Our situation, much like the one you or I meet in lawsuits. You get a client who's very bothered by a lawsuit. He's bothered about it, he calls you and says, will you please do something about negotiating and disposing of this lawsuit? You call up the other side and they say, dismiss it. And you call your client back and you can present to your client the opportunity of stopping his lawsuit, which he doesn't want. And you go on and on and on. And this is just about the circumstance we're in. We're being invited to quit as a sole alternative, and therefore the mechanics become a problem. Whether you're talking about Geneva conferences or the United Nations or other means, to the extent that attitude exists, on what basis do we talk to whom, where, and how?
We're going to get into some of these alternatives in a minute. Mr. Gould had his hand up right after you finished, Mr. Green, and then we'll see if we can get everybody in.
Well, I apparently am the only one on the panel that believes that there is truly a possibility of a negotiated settlement. I think that any move on the part of Ho Chi Minh to come to the conference table could buy him probably the best settlement a nation could ever get. I think that the climate is right now, the people of this nation do not want this war. Hawks or doves, none of us want this war. All of us, I'm sure, want to see it settled and settled on a proper basis. And I'm sure that if Ho Chi Minh would come to the conference table, arrangements for a lasting peace might be negotiated that would result in the rebuilding and revitalizing of North Vietnam and South Vietnam to the betterment, perhaps, of all of Southeast Asia and perhaps...
Everyone will get an opportunity to talk about this. Let me, so that we will have a definite subject matter before us, put three alternate proposals that have been made by various people from time to time, and there have been many others, of course, to try to settle what we are in now. Senator Robert Kennedy suggested last March that, first of all, we should stop bombing North Vietnam, make a clear statement of the kind of settlement we hope to achieve, and that this would recognize that a compromise was a desirable thing, and that we should look forward to a settlement which involved some form of